Good evening and welcome back to another week and show of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrian Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned in the next hour. We've got a great show coming up for everyone. The first part, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeep Rice, the program manager for habitat assessment and marine chemistry at the Auk Bay Fisheries Laboratory for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Marine Fisheries Service in Juneau, Alaska. With the upcoming 23rd anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, we'll be discussing his role and extensive field work conducted after that tragic event, among many other topics. In the second half of the show, I'll also be talking with a scientist, Michael Goldstein. He is executive director of the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center at the University of Alaska Southeast, which is located here in Juneau. Remember, listeners, you can find the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. You can like the project there and post questions for the listeners or stay up to date with the weekly interviews. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project or go to my blog, adrianchile.blogspot.com, and find recordings and information and beautiful pictures of all my guests that I post there. So, Jeep Rice has a PhD in comparative physiology and toxicology from Kent State University and a Bachelor of Science, Master's of Science in Biological Science from Chico State University. He started his career with NOAA in 1971 as a biologist and was assigned to work on the environmental impact statement for the pending Trans-Alaska Pipeline and to start a new program in oil toxicology that will be relevant to Alaska fisheries issues. This program was significantly increased in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, with over 50 researchers from Auk Bay eventually conducting fieldwork in Prince William Sound that same year. Jeep has been the program manager for habitat studies at the Auk Bay Laboratory since the mid-1980s. He provides leadership and management for lab and field projects, mostly supported by a variety of soft funds. Jeep, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I know we're kind of at an interesting date and coincided to have you on with the upcoming 23rd anniversary. And for those who don't know, it was on March 24th, 1989.
Right.
Which not
good
to be...
Good Friday.
Good Friday. Not to be confused with the earthquake on March 27th, which was...
Which was also on Good Friday.
Also Good Friday.
25 years earlier.
So
what will happen 25 years?
I know. My kids better not be in town. Anyway, let's just start talking about how you became involved in this spill, this kind of accident, tragic spill. It happened, and were your researchers dispatched at the time immediately after, or did you go up a few months later?
No, we all went up literally within days of the spill, a couple of days of the spill. Our job really was we kind of started working on the spill long before it ever happened. My boss who hired me is Ted Merrill, and he had the vision to know or think or foresee that there would be a very significant oil industry in Alaska. So he hired me to start that sort of a program, being a toxicologist and all. And so part of the things that we did was to do baseline studies, for example, in the Prince William Sound in anticipation of a spill event, and doing oil toxicity studies. We had chemists as part of the staff, chemists and biologists, and most of the other agencies, for example, only had their specialty biologists, whether a sea otter biologist or a bird biologist or whatever. But we had a balance of both chemists and biologists, and so when the spill happened, we were kind of dispatched up there literally within days, and we're a resource. Most of the other studies, other peoples, they all needed to have chemists available to them and some knowledge of that. And we had Jeff Short was a chemist that worked with me for many, many years. Jeff was on board. I put him and Pat Harris on a boat, for example, on about day three or four, and they started out into the sound gathering water samples, for example. And a week or so later, Alex Wertheimer and other guys from the lab, I put them on a purse seiner to go out and catch pink salmon to look at pink salmon effects, for example, whether they're growing right or not, that sort of thing. We had a lot of different studies.
Yeah. Now, with all your experience before this bill even happened, which is good to know, did researchers coming up from other areas kind of look to you guys as a resource to tell them about the area beforehand?
Well, yeah, the oil expertise, except for what we had in our lab, was really out of state. We had a sister lab, for example, in Seattle that was very heavy into oil effect studies. That's where the oil was going to go, is at Anacortes and other places, and they were involved in spills in the small spills in the Puget Sound area, for example. But they didn't know the area. They didn't know the biology. Mm-hmm. They didn't know about pink salmon, for example, that sort of thing. But they knew about oil. Well, we knew about oil and biology, so we could kind of interface with, say, the herring biologist and with the Department of Fish and Game, or a fish or a bird biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that sort of thing.
Wow. Now, researchers coming in from around the globe, right? I mean, was everybody studying something different?
No, they really weren't, because this is an agency thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is prior to the present law, which was passed called OPA 90, Oil Spill Pollution Act of 1990. Mm-hmm. That's passed 1 year after the Exxon Valdez, and in response to that. So we were operating under what was called the Clean Water Act, and that meant it was litigation sensitive. So we were performing secret studies, so to speak, to look at the damage assessments. There was a response part that was going on with the spill, meaning where's the oil at? Can we get booms there? How are we going to clean it up? How are we going to deal with it? Yeah. So that was very public, and that was very visible, and that's where the cameras were, and all the visibility of the spill was at. Well, another half, and it's almost behind the scenes, was sea otter biologists, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, doing sea otter studies. We were doing pink salmon studies. Fish and Game is doing herring studies. Everybody's doing studies for the resources that they were, that their agency was a trustee of, basically. And we couldn't get too much outside help, at least in the very beginning, because it was lawyer-driven. The studies were driven by, well, how much is that species worth?
Wow.
Sea otters and killer whales and eagles worth a lot because they're visible. The commercial species are worth a lot. But then when you're not into either of those two categories, you're not worth much, you know.
Example, so like herring?
Well, herring were a commercial species then.
Uh-huh.
They're not so
we'll
much
get into
right
that
now.
In a little while.
That's another very important subject. But, well, zooplankton and phytoplankton and, you know, things that are part of the food chain, we couldn't get money to study those because the lawyer said, well, we wouldn't be able to retrieve and sue, basically. We wouldn't be able to sue Exxon to get any value for them.
Wow.
And that's because what is the value of a zooplankton? What if you had a pound of zooplankton? What's that worth? You know, would you buy zooplankton? Would you pay 10 cents or $50, you know? But there was a market value, so to speak, for pink salmon. So you knew what they were and how much herring were worth. And there is an emotional value for, like, eagles. You know, people would say, well, they're worth a couple $100 or something like that. So there's a value for those sort of things.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Now, you must have spent many months there. Did the research go on all summer? Did you leave and come back?
The research went on all summer. It started, of course, literally on day 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it kind of took a while. Well, on day 3, maybe I should back up just a little bit. So the spill happened. It started at night. And it kind of pooled up around the vessel. You know, it's on this rock by reef. And, you know, the vessel is, I don't know, how deep, 30, 40, 50 feet deep. And so the water would come up, the tide would come up. And then when it went down, the oil would leak out of the hold. Mm. There was 8 of the 11 tanks were holed, meaning punctured, ripped open, actually. Punctured, that sounds like a little pinhole. These things are ripped open, gashed, big. And so as the tide went out, then oil would drip out. But it was just kind of pooling around the vessel. Well, then on day 3, out of the north, you're from Valdez, you get a little bit of wind every once in a while in the north. And it was 70 knots. And in just literally 24 hours, it went from literally zero shoreline impacted to about 100 miles of shoreline. And then, you know, within 7 days of that, there's probably 200 plus miles of beaches that were contaminated. When you think over what happened a year and a half ago or so at Deepwater Horizon, it took 50 days or so for oil to actually get ashore.
Uh-huh.
And this happened literally in three days. It's just everywhere and out of control. And so any thought or any fantasy, so to speak, of containing and controlling this oil spill and keeping it from doing much harm just, boom, was instantly disappeared on that third and fourth day when it was just spread with wind.
So. Everywhere. Wow.
And then it was really gooky. You've certainly seen pictures, and the national media had it. And, I mean, oil in some of the bays is literally a foot or so thick and going up and down with the tides and, you know, just coating the rocks and getting into the gravels. And that sort of thing. So it's just a very, sticky mess. Of course, it just doesn't, clean up very easily.
And that's actually one of the questions I had from a listener about the way oil was removed from the beaches. And if it was actually more harmful the way they were doing it, they had the big spray things, or would it have been better to have left it there?
Well,
they didn't have any methods, really.
It kind of depends on who do you want to hold the risk, so to speak. And I'll give you an example. So if you were worried about limpets, for example, and maybe mussels and this thing, and little bitty snails that grow in the intertidal zone and that sort of thing, well, the cleanup methods are pretty harsh on those species. This is a very messy oil, so it wasn't like cleaning up a vegetable oil spill in your kitchen, It was just anywhere and everywhere, and it was ugly, and it was toxic. It was toxic to inhale the fumes of and whatnot, so it was just very difficult. There's just no, you just couldn't wipe it up with a rag. It was in amongst all the cracks and nooks and crannies, like any beach would be, with all the rocks and the fauna that's there, the mussels and limpets and that sort of thing. So they use various methods, mostly flooding it with water. In some cases, they used hot water, which would be lethal to those mussels and those limpets that sort of thing. So, yes, it did them harm. There's just no doubt about it. But the oil would have also done them harm. I mean, they were kind of, in a way, toast. You just kind of had to say, well, if you're coated with this much oil, you're just not going to survive. If you survive, you're not going to reproduce. If you're supposed to live a year, you're not going to live a year, So you're just kind of toast. You kind of had to bite the bullet and write them off. So really, when you're talking about cleaning up the beaches, whatever is contaminated and damaged is almost irreparably damaged. You have to basically get rid of the oil and then start over, so to speak. New things will hopefully come back if the environment is clean, and that was the strategy. Clean the heck out of the beaches, do whatever they possibly could, and they did. And it was harmful and it was destructive, but clean beaches will recover with time. Sometimes a lot of time, because part of the cleaning process may take part of the fine sand grains in which worms or other living things will need that sort of substrate. So it can be physically damaged, and we often think of the swamps, for example, or the wetlands, I should say, in Louisiana. I mean, the highest priority of all down there in that particular spill was to try and prevent the oil to get into those wetlands and save that habitat, because oil is so destructive to the habitat, and cleaning it up is even worse. But if you don't, then the oil persists for a long, long time. And so there's a spill, for example, in Massachusetts, it's a small spill. It's a Florida barge type spill, and is the name of the vessel. And you can still find oil there. It's never cleaned up. Got into some wetlands, with the grasses and that sort of thing, the muds and the fiddler crabs and that sort of thing. You can still find oil there. So it will just persist for a long, long time. So with Exxon Valdez, we cleaned the surface off. I should say Exxon did. They had an army of close to 10,000 people working in each of the first two summers, and a fairly big force in the third summer also. And then you had Mother Nature pounding those shorelines all winter long with storms and whatnot. So when you went there on, say, year three and year four, and you were, say, naive and hadn't been doing a lot of work there, you'd say, wow, this place is looking pretty clean. But then if you dug a pit and you went below the surface about, 3 inches or so, 4 inches, you could find oil in many spots. And then, so we kind of knew that there was some oil there. And then our lab with Jeff Short and Mandy Lindeberg and others leading it, we dug a whole bunch of pits. We dug about 9,000 pits.
All over the Sound.
In the summer of 2001. And it was a very, not a very sophisticated study in terms of technology. It was people digging pits. We hired a bunch of people, for example, from the village of Chinega to help us dig these pits and whatnot. We analyzed some of the samples. Yep, this is still Exxon Valdez oil. And the amazing thing was, it was unweathered oil. It was as if it was only 2 weeks old.
Really? After how many years?
And it was because it was anaerobic. It wasn't exposed to the air. So once you get below the surface about 3 inches, water doesn't penetrate it much anymore, and oxygen doesn't get it there. Then the bacteria can't do much good, and so it just stays there in its pristine state, basically.
Wow.
And so if you can expose that oil, it's still toxic, it's still fluid. You could light it with a match, you know. I mean, it's that sort of consistency. So that's what you'll get if you don't clean up oil. So you're left not with what's the smartest thing to do or what's the best thing. You're now left with choices of what's the lesser of evils. Do we clean it up harsh and then help nature maybe come back and recover and different grasses mm-hmm. and the different algaes will recolonize and the limpets will come back, that sort of thing? Or do you let nature take its course? And there's a winner and a loser there, but I think in the long run there have been more losers than winners. Our best example of a long-term effect are sea otters.
The
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Brenda Balachi and whatnot, they have a study that shows a population effect on a small group that are in the northern Knight Island area. This is kind of like the center of the bomb, so to speak, the epicenter of the oil spill. In this area there, the population was drastically reduced from the spill, and those that survived did not come back in population numbers for literally about 15, 18, 20
wow.
years.
Wow.
Some place in there, I'm not sure what date, but their population just barely held on level, and then it took a long time before it started to inflect up. Whereas the otters that were killed, say, in other parts of Western Prince William Sound, they were, you know, those carcasses are counted and collected one up. But their population numbers started coming back up in the year after the spill because the habitat wasn't too contaminated But where the habitat remained contaminated, then those animals are basically getting a new spill every year, so to speak. It's a lesser amount because Mother Nature is continuously turning over those gravels, exposing some of it to oxygen. Bacteria are working on it. So the amount of oil was decreasing in those sediments, but still, if you were an animal, a worm, or a sea otter that dug pits in the lower intertidal zone, you could become exposed to oil and still have a long-term effect, a chronic effect.
Yeah, wow. So sea otters. What about the herring, Jeep? We brought that up earlier.
Well, the herring are an enigma, a mystery.
Still are, yeah.
They still are. Basically, they were doing very, very well at the time of the spill. The population numbers were at all-time highs. The fishermen were enjoying a very robust fishery there in Prince William Sound. And the fishery, and not only the herring fishery, but the pink salmon fisheries, the black cod fisheries, were all closed in 1989. One, nobody wanted them to harvest any oil-contaminated fish and that sort of thing, and put it on the market and hurt other fisheries, like the Bristol Bay fishery or something like that. So they didn't want to affect the markets. But also, biologically, they didn't know how many herring would survive, and so they didn't want to have a herring fishery on a population that was, say, getting killed by the oil, say, half of them or something like that. And we wouldn't know. I mean, we're not going to be able to know what happened to the herring in that very first year. It's just kind of a black box. You know, if they're floating on the surface like sea otters and like birds, you can find them and you can say, wow, we're having a significant effect. Common MERS, for example, there's hundreds of carcasses. They're the single vertebrate species with the hardest hit in terms of numbers. And there's just large rafts of these birds that were found. But for the fish, they don't float. And something else comes along and eats them, either just before they die or soon thereafter. So you don't find carcasses and that sort of thing. So you can't, it's hard to know how many are there unless you do a real intensive stock assessment.
Mm.
So anyway, the herring population appeared to still be intact the year after and the year after. And then in 93, even though there's predictions of a good fishery, when the fishermen went out there, there weren't any fish to fish. In the population, it dropped some 80% or so down to about 20 or 15 to 20 or so percent of the population that they thought was there the year before. So the fisheries are closed, and then they've, I think they're open once since for 1 year, but they've been pretty much below the threshold harvest level ever since. Bumping along, not going downhill as in extinction or anything, but not rebounding. And herring populations, you know, herring has, I don't know how many eggs, 30,000, 50,000, I don't know how many eggs, but they have the capacity, if the environment is right, to really rebound population-wise in fairly short order, in a couple of 3 or 4 or 5 years, they can rebound. And that's what happens. You see populations ebb, and they may be down there, and then they come back up and go down and that sort of thing. No population stays the same, but this population has remained depressed since 1993 and basically not fished since then. The catch is, though, we were studying herring very intensely, Fish and Game in particular, and a lot of contractors, intensely in 89 and 90 and 91, and they really, they found effects on eggs and larvae, okay? They could go out and find and trawl up small amounts of eggs and whatnot, and they would be deformed in the larvae and that sort of thing. So the 1989 brood year basically didn't exist. So there was an effect of the spill on the 1989 brood year. But the herring population is made up of 8, 10, maybe even up to 11 or 12 different year classes at any one time. And and these were appeared to be ineffective. And then the 93 crash comes, but nobody was studying herring in those years because nothing had happened in the first year or two of the spill. So why did they crash? You know, well, some of them were diseased, and disease appears to be a part of the picture, but did the oil somehow make them vulnerable to the disease? We don't know.
You guys couldn't go back and look at it?
Can't go back. It's gone. It's, the data wasn't collected. You know, those questions weren't asked, and so the samples weren't taken, and so we don't know the answer. We don't know what the health of them in terms of being fit, you know, how robust were the fish going through the winter? Were they being starved to death or not? And then the disease had an effect. You know, what's the role of oil? So we didn't do the intense studies in, say, 92 and 93 that would help answer some of those questions. So trying to go back and assess, well, is it the oil or is it, you know, Mother Nature throwing us a curve or what? You know, we don't know those answers. And we never will. There's some suggestions, and it's not strong evidence, that the decline actually started in 89 at the time of the spill. Instead of starting in 93, it started in 89. And, you know, but we can't prove, that's kind of like back calculating, you know. We can't prove that that's, in fact, what happened. We can't prove it one way or the other. What we can still show is they're just still at relatively low levels for reasons we probably don't know. So now the question is, well, what? Why do they remain low? Certainly it's not the oil. There's virtually no oil present in Prince William Sound except for those limited number of beaches.
Okay.
And if the herring are spawning on those specific beaches, like in Herring Bay up in Knight Island or Naked Island, that sort of area, but that's not where they spawn. They're spawning down toward the entrance of Hinchin Brook and other areas over on the east side. Areas that were never oiled. So the presence, the lingering oil that's there might affect sea otters that dig pits there, but it's not affecting herring. So, you know, it's not the oil. So then what is it? Well, it appears as a big culprit is probably humpback whales.
That
once the population gets depressed into smaller numbers, the whales are able to crop off a number that keeps them from expanding back up to their peaceful levels.
Interesting.
So that's kind of where we're at right now. But while the evidence is pretty suggestive of that's not hard and fast, one of the evolutionary things that the Trustee Council, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, EVOS Trustee Council, has done is they've decided that they're going to invest some of the funds that they have remaining from the billion-dollar settlement they got in 1991. They're investing and focusing it on herring.
Okay.
And the logic is, well, yeah, it's an important commercial fishery that no longer exists, but herring are kind of like one of the most important forage species of the Sound. They're important for concentrating the energy from the copepods and very small invertebrates into them, and then that they are then eaten by birds, by fish, by marine mammals, a host of marine mammals, including the humpback whales. So they're kind of like a energetic bottleneck. You know, the energy has to be focused through these herring for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's other species, candlefish and a couple of other forage fish, but none of them are in the quantities that herring are. So herring are the main bottleneck that energy is funneled through, so to speak. So the Sound would be a healthier place if we had herring in more robust numbers. And so, it's a target. We want to get them up into higher levels. How do we do that? We can say, well, don't fish them. Well, we haven't been fishing them for nearly 20 years now almost. And, so if that were the fix, well, they would have been fixed by now.
True.
So, what are we going to do about it? So they've decided they would invest a significant amount of funds in trying to monitor the health of the Sound in terms of oceanography, in terms of energy and the plankton, for example, how many humpback whales are out there preying on herring, and a series of herring studies also, so that in another 10 or 20 years, we can actually have a much better handle on the information of what it takes to keep herring going in proper numbers, assuming they return. What are the pluses and minuses that are going on, so to speak, that are holding that population where they're at?
Yeah.
To answer the questions that we couldn't answer following that 1993 crash.
Wow, there's a lot involved there. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. I was hoping to get in a bunch of more questions, but
when it comes to biology,
you know a lot, Chief. If you're just tuning in for the last few minutes here, we're talking to Chief Rice from the Alaska Fishery Science Center here. Now, I was going to try to get in your reaction when you heard of the Gulf disaster, because it actually was a bigger oil spill than Valdez.
It was.
And then if we're prepared in the Arctic, I don't know if we can get those two things in the next few minutes.
I'll give it a 2-minute shot. Exxon Valdez was a record oil spill for U.S. waters, the largest spill in U.S. waters in history up until the Deepwater Horizon, and then it surpasses it by about 25 times. It's kind of hard to tell. And, there's a saying in oil spill biology, no two spills are alike. And boy, these two spills are very, very different. One being a blowout, meaning a continuous event. The volume is a relatively thin oil. They used 1 million gallons of dispersants in combating that spill, and virtually no dispersants in Exxon Valdez. So the oils are different. The habitat is different.
Yeah,
the temperatures are different. Microbial degradation is fundamentally different. The depth of Deepwater Horizon is humongous in terms of the depth there. So they're not alike. The one message that you get out of Deepwater Horizon is, though, that dispersants, which have really been frowned upon in North America, at least in the U.S., they appear to have worked. They appear to have dispersed the oil, making a bioavailable to the microbes, and the microbes ate them up, and we didn't get as many adverse effects as I think that we should have gotten for the volume of oil spilled.
Yeah.
Having said that, the jury's out. Let's reevaluate that in another 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. Is there a crash of bluefin tuna or something else going to happen that we can't foresee, that we don't understand? Right now it would appear that spill has gotten a remarkable low amount of damage for the volume of oil spill. But now we're heading toward the Arctic. Good idea, bad idea, doesn't matter. We're probably going to go ahead with it. The economics are there. The energy demand is there. The politics are lining up to be there, et cetera. So it doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on that. It's probably going to happen. Well, the Exxon Valdez spill becomes the best piece of information source, so to speak, in trying to understand what may happen up there. It's not as cold as the Arctic. It's certainly a lot colder than deep water horizon.
Yeah.
And it does give us pause. When we look at killer whales, for example, herring, pink salmon were effective for 4 years, sea otters, persistence into the 20, I can take you out there and I can have Mandy Lindenberg take you out there, it would probably be a better way to put it, and dig a pit and we can see oil. You know, so if we have a spill in the Arctic, we have to believe it's going to behave much more toward Exxon Valdez type of patterns. Certainly it's not the same environment, but mm-hmm. it's colder, microbes should work less effective up there. There's wetlands all along the shorelines, lagoons in the Arctic, from Barrow East and Barrow Southwest, you know, wherever the oil goes, ends up. So the site, I often think the site that has the highest probability of an impact is where the spill site is, but it's the nearshore environment that will be have the highest probability of long-term damage if the oil gets there and long-term persistence.
Wow.
And that's kind of a scary thought to say.
Yeah, no, there's definitely got to be a lot of people like you looking at it. And maybe we'll have you back, Chief. I think
right.
we could cover some more ground in the next interview with you. But those listening, we're just speaking with Chief Rice. He's the Program Manager for Habitat Assessment and Marine Chemistry, the Auk Bay Fisheries Lab for NOAA, and then NIMS. NIMS is the short word for it. Stay tuned. In the next half hour, we'll be having Michael Goldstein here in the studio from the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez. We are back here on KTO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned. We had a great interview in the first part of the show with Jeep Rice, who is the Program Manager for Habitat Assessment and Marine Chemistry at the Auk Bay Fisheries Laboratory here for NOAA. Great interview on the Exxon Valdez oil spill with the anniversary coming up on Saturday. That'll be 23 years since that disaster happened in Valdez. In the next half hour, we have Michael Goldstein, or Mike. He's from the Alaska Coastal Research Center. He came from the U.S. Forest Service Wildlife and Terrestrial Ecology Program in Alaska, where he served as a wildlife ecologist on the Chugach National Forest in south central Alaska. Earlier, he worked as the Wildlife Program Director for Mendocino Redwood Company in Northern California. He received his Ph.D. in Wildlife and Fishery Sciences from Texas A&M University in 2000, and his Master's in Science and Environmental Toxicology from Clemson University in 1997, and his B.S. in Wildlife Biology from Colorado State University in 1989. Mike has worked primarily in landscape ecology, measuring the effects of human activities on biodiversity in complex landscapes. This includes assessments of vertebrates inhabiting fragmented ecosystems under heavy management pressures that have resulted in over 30 publications and book chapters and numerous presentations. Thanks for coming on the show, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, a beautiful night out there.
Wonderful.
Well, for those who are out there in Juneau, and maybe southeast, not just in Juneau, but southeast and around Alaska and around the world that don't know what the center is that you're executive director of, what would you tell them is the focus of it, or the mission, or some of the objectives of the Coastal Research Center?
The Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center serves as a collaborative environment, a nexus for partners to come together for research and education and policy development.
Okay.
It's just been around for a couple of years. And it was formed through a partnership through a number of organizations and housed at the University of Alaska Southeast. So UAS and UAF and UAA are all partners.
All partners as well.
The Forest Service Research Branch is a partner.
Okay.
Forest Service Alaska Region. The Fish and Wildlife Service. The USGS. The NOAA Fisheries.
NOAA's, okay.
The NOAA's National Weather Service is part of the Rainforest Center.
Great.
The City and Borough of Juneau kind of makes us a little bit unique to have a municipality involved at that level, with Mayor Botello's involvement. There's also a government agency from British Columbia, the Ministry of Forest, Lands, and Natural Resource Operations. It's like their Forest Service in Canada.
That's cool.
So there's also the Juneau Economic Development Council as a partner, the Central Council, Tlingit and Haida. And that's really another great opportunity to integrate science and traditional ecological knowledge together in this collaborative environment. And then there's two non-government organizations, the Nature Conservancy, who's done a lot of work with the Tongass Futures Roundtable, and a lot of habitat and ecological modeling in Southeast, and the Geos Institute, which has also done a lot of work with climate adaptation strategies.
Okay, Geos. And where are they based?
They're based in Ashland, Oregon.
In Ashland, okay.
So our partnership network, you know, ranges across the Coast Temperate Rainforest and the Pacific Coast of North America.
You know, you said it was rare that, like, a city or a municipality would be interested in this, but wouldn't research and this whole Rainforest Center, correct me if I say research center, isn't there a benefit for the city to be involved? Because it's building up our city here in Juneau, right, and keeping jobs here.
Quite. There's, you know, in a lot of ways, many of the ideas and strategies that came out of the mayor's panel for climate change, which ended with a report a few years ago, built upon this kind of partnership environment that when you look at climate adaptation or adaptation strategies for climate focus areas, you need a broad partnership involved. So having the municipality step up and step into an operative environment like this allows us to address challenges, I think, that many other organizations can't.
Yeah, that's great. So besides all these partners, you must have staff and scientists working with you. I saw something about scientists could also partner with you on the website.
Yeah, the way we've worked it is that, you know, we have internally, we're seven employees based at UAS. So the Rainforest Center in just a couple of years has gone from a blank slate to an organization of seven employees through a combination of soft and hard funding. But we also have the opportunity for scientists and educators to join our affiliate scientist program. And that's when they have a kind of a unique and desired interest to work with us across the collaborative shell that we provide to embrace some of the values or the mission of the center to propel their research forward, to build out capacity in some of their programs.
Wow.
Yeah. So one of the primary ways that we've done that and worked across this kind of broader arena is what we call our cross-boundary data integration projects. And it's a series of projects that we and all of our partners are involved in, and they're from everything from data and GIS development, landscape level development, to database development, to looking at some of the end user products. That could be simple modeling techniques to look at alteration in systems. It could be more complex and dynamic environments to look at soils or stream flow or other capacities like that that might be engaging for different communities or different interests out there.
Okay.
So I could, you know, you could talk about soils, you could talk about water levels, and if you have low flow levels, what that could be doing in the future toward the ability for salmon to spawn or for eggs to hatch or smolder fry to make it through the system.
Yeah, yeah. Important to know. Now, part of, I guess, this idea being born of the Rainforest Center is that there's a problem of too much research on Alaska being done outside of Alaska, right? That there's a whole Alaska Science Center in Seattle, and yet we're Alaska, right? So you want to keep some of that here. Bring it back from Seattle, too, right?
There's a lot of work that's done in Alaska by folks who don't live, within Southeast or within the borders of the state.
Mm-hmm.
This center is probably going to be the largest center that'll be working through it at the University of Alaska Southeast. We hope that the model centers and institutes that you see at UAA and UAF mm-hmm. kind of provide that kind of greater understanding for how those collaborations can work. And if we can bring an organization to the front here in Southeast where people can partner,
mm-hmm.
Then a lot of the work can be based out of and housed here at UAS.
Right. So there's a model from UAF or UAA that you guys are kind of...
We are heavily involved with the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, the SNAP program at UAF.
SNAP.
And their director, Scott Rupp, has served as an advisor in an advisory capacity to the growth of the Rainforest Center over the past couple of years. And we look at the work that they've done and how they've done it, as a great model. They grew from a small organization to about a 28-person outfit. Okay. And whereas we don't think that necessarily we can grow to that size, we firmly believe that we're probably an 11- to 15-person organization a few years out,
right.
Sustainably. Yeah.
Well, so what are some of the coastal temperate rainforest issues that you are addressing? And what are some of the more important ones right now that are being looked at, I guess, where the public can get involved with as well or should be aware of?
One of the biggest reasons why the partners wanted the center to be founded and housed at UAS was kind of a unique collaborative environment that allows mm-hmm. them to talk to each other in a more productive and progressive way.
Mm-hmm.
So that cross-boundary work is much more than just the ability for us to build a matrix or a database or whatnot, but it's an opportunity for people to gather either by webinar, face-to-face, by phone, and discuss and get at some of the different issues that are driving, whether it be... And the largest one of those that is kind of central to a lot of the news today is some of the effects of, or potential effects of, climate-derived change,
mm-hmm.
Reduction in glaciers, alteration in stream flow, hydrology changes, precipitation changes. A lot of the work that's being done, at the research lab for the Forest Service, the Juneau Forestry Sciences Lab, looking at die-off of certain tree species or the movement of invasive species into an environment
mm-hmm.
that's monitored or modeled through any one of the agencies that or universities here.
Mm.
So what we've tried to do is build onto those initiatives and build onto those approaches and not reinvent the wheel, but work with people in a capacity that just helps augment their research. Under that kind of umbrella slogan that we're designed under, which is integrating science, resource management, and communities,
mm-hmm.
and really taking a harder look at how those three are kind of woven together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the value system that we embrace.
Nice. Now, on that aspect of communities, there's a lot of your work that involves raising awareness, right, in some communities. Has that been a focus of the center, getting out and... doing talks and getting other people involved outside of Juneau?
There's a whole suite of different ways we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
We've been lucky enough to partner with a lot of different organizations, including the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, in a kind of a surveying approach to different watersheds, and that's called BioBlitz.
BioBlitz,
A 24-hour survey of a particular watershed with a strong array of species experts that come from all over the temperate rainforest region. We've had scientists come down from Fairbanks and up from Oregon to participate. We've had two here in Juneau, one in Portage, another one in Sitka this August. And this year, led by Kristen Romanoff and Steve Brockman and several others from agencies local, there'll be a fourth grade BioBlitz that we're just fortunate enough to continue to be involved with. And that'll be in May, where fourth graders will team up and learn and get some sense of what their kind of community is or what their biodiversity is in their backyard.
Mm-hmm. They call these citizen science, right?
Citizen science type projects. That's correct.
Get involved in the community.
Another one we're looking at is kind of a phenology approach. So looking at when leaf out might be and some of the changes in timing. And that kind of citizen science environment is where you can collect actually the best and most efficient data out there, because there could be people from all over the communities in Southeast that are reporting in when a particular plant species buds out or or its flowers or in play.
Cool.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. It's working in other places, and we're trying to employ it here as well.
Great. Yeah, I try to be a volunteer for it this summer, but it's pretty busy that weekend, whatever that was.
That's right.
I think it was right after Maritime Festival. Mike, let's get in some time, the next 10 minutes or so, about the symposium, because I know that's a very important part of the Rainforest Center, Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Michael Goldstein. He's the executive director. The next few months, right? You're going to be leaving soon.
Yeah, I can just briefly say I'm just honored. I've worked for the Forest Service for the last, 9 years, and I was put on loan. I received this opportunity, and I was put on loan from the Forest Service to UAS to work to build up this program, and that detail ends in May. And I'll return back to the regional office of the Forest Service, to the Alaska Region Office, here in downtown Juneau, where I'll work on kind of special projects related to climate, the climate science centers, the landscape initiatives that are going on, and the partnership programs for the agency there. And UAS is hiring and currently reviewing, has an open review of applications right now to replace me in the executive director position, which we're hoping we'll have somebody filled by, May, June of this year.
Okay, great. Yeah. So you're going back.
Yeah, so our symposium.
So a symposium is happening in April. We want to let the public know. It's an important event. Tell us a little bit about it and who is coming from around the world, right?
Well, we've been really successful thus far. We've had several workshops that we've held over the past year and a half, and people have come from all over to visit, and we decided to try and have a marquee event using our branding and slogan, Coastal Temperate Rainforest, Integrating Science, Resource Management, and Communities, and take a pretty hard look at the environment here. And it's a three-day event, April 17, 18, and 19. The first day is a field trip where we get to spend the bulk of the day out on an Allan Marine catamaran going up to Berners Bay with a whole suite of species and systems experts, where we can just get the whole gamut in small chunks with a nice environment, taking a look at perhaps the Hooligan Run or some movements of sea lions, or taking a look at the glaciers and talking about those systems in the intertidal zone, and looking up at the Hien-Latini Experimental Forest, which is the Forest Service's newest experimental forest, which whose paperwork was signed about the same time that the Rainforest Center's paperwork, Memorandum of Understanding, was signed.
Hien-Latini,
River Watcher. And there's a beautiful watershed out the road in Juneau, and Rick Edwards is the chief scientist from the Forest Service and in charge of managing the scientific efforts that are going on at the Hien-Latini. And we'll talk about that, not from within it, but with a view of it.
Okay.
Anyhow, so we have, 9 or 10 different talks that day on this five-hour boat ride. It should be great. You can find this information on our website, acrc.alaska.edu. And there's program information and registration information, and we have quite a large number of people signed up already. I think the field trip is still has a few open slots, but it's nearing its closing. And then on that night, we have the first of one of the large keynote talks, and that's an open public reception. And that is Dr. Peter Kariva, who's the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy.
Nice.
And he's coming in. He's going to actually be giving us two talks, one that night and an open public reception at Centennial Hall on the 17th in the evening. He's going to be talking about Alaska's place in a conservation framework, taking lessons learned from the lower 48 and other places around the world and looking at the beauty and vast wonders of Alaska and the great industries that we have here that JEDC and others are heavily involved with, particularly, you know, whether it's mining or timber or renewable energy or, you know, visitor products or ocean products, all of those different opportunities, and looking at the utilization of those in a conservation framework, where how those two are integrated and tied together in his vision and viewpoint. And he's a well-rounded and well-known speaker, and I hope he comes and helps us open some eyes and have strong and thorough debate about the opinions that might come forth that evening. So we welcome the public to that open public reception on the 17th in the evening to see Peter Kariva and hear that talk, Alaska's Place in the Future of Conservation. The next 2 days we're at Centennial Hall, the 18th and the 19th, and we have a number of sessions. We open with Kirk Johnson from the National Academy of Sciences, coming out from Denver. And Kirk might be known to some as a co-author on Cruising the Fossil Freeway with Ray Troll. He's done a lot of work with Ray Troll.
He was on our show.
And so
Ray was.
You've seen and heard some of Kirk's work, though he's definitely let's say more the science side and less the artistic side,
I've
heard it said. And Kirk is coming to give us a great kind of talk on Earth's deep time past, his view and vision of how we actually have and where we have coastal temperate rainforest today from the ecologic progression throughout the millennia, throughout the Earth's deep time past. And he brings us to the present, and then we take a look at the present modern day coastal temperate rainforest regions around the world, Chile, New Zealand, Japan, a few other locales. And we specifically look at affinities that might be seen between the Pacific Coast region and some of those regions, or some of the contrasts and similarities. And from that point forward, we really hone further and further in on the Pacific Coast region. And we talk about some specific problems and beauties and benefits of the, you know, coastal temperate rainforest here where we live, you know, from the Kenai down to the Redwoods. And we have one great speaker who's coming in to cap off that first morning session, Ken Lertzman from Simon Fraser University, who's going to talk about cultural resiliency and the look at the long-term resiliency of communities. And that is really apt and apropos as we hear more and more about certain communities needing to have assisted migration from one site to another due to rising sea level or other, you know, changes in hydrology or hydrography. At lunch that day,
we don't have that.
Oh, do we have a little bit more time?
We only have like 3 more minutes.
Give us a little bit of
a couple of the other speakers.
We have Terry Chapin coming down from Fairbanks. We have Dr. Dolly Garza coming back up from Haida Gwaii, and Elaine Abraham coming down from Anchorage to talk about traditional ecological knowledge and some of the histories there. We have a really interesting and dynamic look at climate adaptation strategies and
mitigation
approaches. We have a really nice look at this cross-boundary work that we've been trying to work through. And we have some pretty interesting, and I think this is going to open some eyes. We have some pretty heavy hitters coming in to talk about ecosystem services in general. So the stocks and flows, the values of primary productivity in the coast temperate rainforest region and what it means and how you value those systems. And there's been a lot of work done in other places and very little done here. Huh. We have a suite of experts coming in to talk about that as well. And then we have
economic development.
Development mm-hmm. and the services that our ecosystems provide for our communities and our industries and our people. And I think those who come and take a look at that are going to be really excited. And we have another great session it's called Change at Our Doorstep. And it's looking at climate change from the eyes of teachers and students, Clinkett and Haida students, DZ middle school students. There are some elementary school students coming in to talk about their perspectives. And we also have a really neat policy session. We're actually going to compare and contrast some Tongass work and some Great Bear Rainforest work in British Columbia.
Wow.
And try and tie those policy dynamics together, where we have challenges and issues and things that have occurred with the Tongass Futures Roundtable. We have other challenges and issues and successes that have occurred at the Great Bear framework. And it's going to be neat to try and tie those together a little bit.
Wow, so people are out there. You can go to the website.
acrc.alaska.edu. Please take a look. See if you'd like to come. Get in touch with us. We're waiting and interested to see you come to the symposium mid-April.
In mid-April, yeah. Get people involved. This is the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center putting on a temperate rainforest symposium, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So
thank you,
Michael. Thanks, everyone listening out there. It's been a great show. Stay tuned for the Alaska Identity Project next week. Have a great night.